coming up this week?
It'll be interesting to come back to this and see how well these questions age after we do start getting some answers.
Definitely, definitely. One of the benefits of putting something out on the internet is it's never deleted.
I'll be regretting my words in no time.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to episode 191 of the EV Resource Podcast. I'm Zach Hurst, and each week I bring you the latest EV news, information, and interviews with industry experts. This week, I am joined by Andy Cooper and John Hurst. We're going to be talking about the latest in the world of EV news. A lot of big stories have emerged over the last week and a half or so. So we're going to dive right into it. Guys, thank you so much for joining me again. This is honestly one of the ones that I really look forward to recording because it's a little bit more informal, just sitting around having a chat about what's going on.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you for letting me join in.
Of course. Yes. So normally I like to give people a chance to introduce themselves. I know, John, you've been on the podcast before, and Andy, actually, I can't think if you've been in front of the audience in this way before, but of course you and I talk quite a bit and you've been a longtime supporter on Patreon. So I guess, Andy, if you want to take a second to kind of introduce yourself and say, you know, where you're from, what kind of car you've got, and then John, you can kind of recap for those who might not know as well.
Yeah. So I'm Andy Cooper. I'm probably known, if at all, for more for the car that I drive, because that's been featured more, which is totally understandable. But I have a GV60, and I bought that in it's coming on 2 years ago. And leading up to that point, I've just been kind of digging into the EV scene. I'm, in relative terms, new to the EV scene compared to many other people who have been there since the 80s and 10 years and beyond. I've only been doing it for a couple of years, but it's been a fascination point for me. And I've, you know, just kind of been absorbing as much information, especially from your podcast, Zach, this whole time. So I love talking about it. And thank you for having me on and letting me have to do this.
Of course.
I'm John. I'm Zach's brother. I drive the Spark. I like that I can just say that. It's just the Spark. And that was my first electric vehicle. And it's great to, after having been interested in EVs for quite some time, actually, you know, be driving an EV. And I have a background in IT and teaching. That's something that the audience doesn't know yet.
Probably not.
Yeah.
So things have been happening, which, I mean, things are always happening in the EV space, and it seems like it's very difficult to just keep up with it all. But probably the biggest story in the EV industry, and really more so the EV charging side of things, is the big announcement that Tesla is pretty much, well, had already laid off almost their entire supercharger team that's in charge of basically building out new sites. It's important to note that it does not include anybody that's related to maintaining the existing infrastructure. That's all safe. But building out new sites, that doesn't look like it's going to happen. And that's left a lot of people having questions within the industry. There's even people at utilities that were working on multiple new supercharger sites. They have no contact at Tesla. They can send an email, but it gets bounced back. Let's talk about this, because while the two of you don't own Teslas and use supercharger stations, you still have enough experience to be able to look at the bigger picture and go, all right, here's what you think.
Yeah. I've been listening to all kinds of stuff this week about it, and there's very few situations where I hear there a positive spin on this. It's if you look at it, I know that there's the whole concept of applying Occam's razor, just in terms of like the most simplest explanation, you know, is probably the best. But Yeah, this just seemed like a fit of spite. Like, he got some pushback from a manager and he just took it out on everybody. I don't think there was any marketing analysis behind him doing this kind of thing, or I just don't think it was a logical process.
He being Elon.
Yes.
Yeah. In case somebody might not connect that.
I don't even know what to think at this point. It's like, well, does that mean Elon has no interest in creating new supercharger sites? Does that mean he just had a problem with the people in that team and is going to rehire all new people? Like, were they talking about going on strike or something? I'm like, okay, well, whatever. You know, it doesn't apply to me specifically, but you know, I'm sure the folks at Rivian are not real happy about it, since, you know, Rivian's been really pushing recently. I've seen some ads related to, oh yeah, these, you know, trucks can use the superchargers now. Yay. And then you get this headline. It's like, okay, where do we go from here?
Yeah. To me, it seems like this, I think he's letting I mean this in a positive way towards Tesla, a monopolistic opportunity, which, you know, any company would want to dive at. I think he's just letting this go. And from a business standpoint, I think it's going to be possibly, and, you know, maybe, I hope I'm wrong, but one of the biggest flubs in the next decade or so.
I'm wondering if the other automakers that have really been excited about adopting NACS charging, if they're starting to think, well, maybe that wasn't the best idea because the person who's kind of in charge of the NACS standard is kind of off his rocker. You know, maybe CCS2 might have been a better way to go. I don't know.
Yeah. So one thing that I think is definitely a concern is, it's been, I want to say, about a week since we found out about this, and we still have all of these questions. We don't know. Of course, Tesla, I don't know how many years ago it was, got rid of their entire PR team. So journalists have nobody to reach out to get answers.
Yeah.
But we don't have answers from anybody, and it's not even that something has leaked from internally to let people, anybody, know what's going on. So
I haven't seen any other information. There's no releases from any other automakers in terms of reaction to this either. Everybody's just kind of gone on radio silent, waiting to see what's going to happen with it.
Yeah.
So that's very strange, because normally when you see a company that's this heavily involved in an industry, especially if they are in an industry where their name is almost synonymous with what the industry is, for them to suddenly say, yeah, we're not going to really do more with this, good luck.
Kind of makes me want Steve Jobs back.
I mean, that would be something. So what I find interesting is most of the news, at least the articles that I've seen on this, basically reference tweets from Elon. Like, that's how we get news about Tesla, is from Elon's tweets.
Much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was a tweet that Elon said that they're going to spend $500 million on expanding the supercharger network. What I've seen related to that is that the intent is to either upgrade or add more superchargers to existing sites. It's not talking about expanding new sites.
Well, expanding existing sites, from what I've seen, would be particularly helpful, but it would also be helpful to have some new sites.
Yeah. Yeah. I've actually, one of my activist members, they had just won a major victory in getting their HOA to agree to install level 2 chargers in their multifamily community.
Nice.
And they went with Tesla though. And so they were in the middle of getting that, you know, underway. And suddenly after the announcement of the firing of the whole department, radio silence again in that situation as well. So they're kind of like, they have a half finished project and they can't contact anyone to get any guidance on what to do next, really. So they're actually possibly considering other vendors now at this point. So,
I mean, you'd have to at that point, especially if they've already worked on a lot of the infrastructure side of it to support whatever equipment's going to be there.
Well, on the plus side, if they have already taken care of a lot of the infrastructure, then that seems like the biggest hurdle to me. Not that I know that much about it, but
infrastructure, you can swap out the, you know, charging station EDSEs pretty readily. I mean, you got some sunk costs in the actual purchase of those, but yeah, that's just some of the fallout that I've been hearing on the results of that, though. Mm.
Yeah, definitely the biggest shakeup in the EV industry since Tesla claimed NACS as being the standard. Like, I mean, it's just, and that was only about a year ago, a little bit more than that. That, I mean, Aptera had made their announcement November previous, but then Ford, as the major manufacturer that was first to announce the move, it really hasn't been that long.
Mm-mm. No, I think the speed at which that everyone eventually came on board was light speed by any comparison in this industry, in the automobile industry. Like, I've never seen anything move that fast before.
Right.
And it was so great. I was like thrilled, because one of the things I feared most about EV adoption was format wars. Mm-hmm. And they'd all just came right on board. You know, what VW was one of the last, which was understandable because they had a lot of, you know, clout behind the previous versions. Mm-hmm. So, that was amazing to me. If I can add also a possible silver lining to this is, you know, all those people that did get fired from Tesla, that's a lot of wonderful expertise that can go to the other incoming providers like the IONNA. And possibly even help EA get, you know, up to speed if they want to hire that kind of expertise and give them some autonomy, you know.
Sure. Well, and even outside of that, you've got a very wide, diverse spectrum of talent where it's not like they were all working on the same thing within that department. You know, you've got a number of different people working on a number of different things. So it could even be spread to equipment suppliers, mm-hmm. or organizations that are involved with interoperability testing. Like, there's really so much opportunity in the industry that I've heard some comments that the industry can't absorb 500 people all searching for jobs related to this. Mm-hmm. I would disagree with that. I know of a number of companies that are actively hiring all the time and cannot get enough people to help. So,
I wouldn't be surprised if out of 500 people, we get one or two startups as well.
I was going to, yeah. I mean, be pretty awesome if Tanucci could get some backer funding and like start or spin off her own thing, you know, and that'd be pretty power. That'd be a big powerhouse in terms of expertise.
So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, it's weird to call this news because the only thing we're saying is, oh crap, like what happened? But then a bunch of questions and speculation. So it's like, okay. But I mean, more often than not, when Tesla does something, that's exactly how everybody responds, with questions and speculation, because nobody really actually knows. Or the people that do know aren't sharing what they know.
It'll be interesting to come back to this and see how well these questions age after we do start getting some answers.
Definitely. Definitely. One of the benefits of putting something out on the internet is it's never deleted.
I'll be regretting my words in no time.
So normally I try to avoid getting into politics. One reason being I don't want to alienate anybody, regardless of what they might think. But then also because I feel like politics has gotten way too polarized. When you look at what's going on in clean tech through a political lens, things get very twisted. All that to say, there's actually two stories that involve, one involves Trump and one involves Biden. So I'm interested to see what you guys think, if you've seen any of this or heard about it. The one related to Trump is, and I'm trying to be respectful, and I don't know what that means to some people these days or not, but there's a report that came out that Trump met with a bunch of oil executives in Mar-a-Lago and basically promised to completely get rid of the EV tax incentives with the IRA in exchange for $1 billion. What do you guys think about this?
Overt, active solicitation of to be bribed?
That's what it sounds like to me.
One of the things that I thought about is, one, EVs shouldn't be politicized because there's really good arguments for EVs, regardless of your political leanings, or including both political leanings, I guess, is a better way to say that. But then also, so much for the advancement of EVs happened during and in some cases as a result of the policies of Trump's administration. It almost seems like there's been a flip there where, I don't know, I would think that if you're a conservative voter, somebody that would typically support Trump, you'd be interested in reducing the United States' dependence on foreign oil, on more control over having things happen here, where the IRA is incentivizing manufacturing to be done in North America. Those are things that I would expect would be desirable.
For anybody who doesn't know, what's IRA stand for?
The Inflation Reduction Act, and a part of that with the EV tax credits, the requirements for a vehicle to qualify, the major supply of parts as well as assembly are two different parts of that bill. That has brought the entire industry manufacturing back to the United States. I mean, you see examples like Volkswagen and their Chattanooga, Tennessee plant. Down in the Carolinas, Toyota has their major battery manufacturing facility either planned or I don't know if they've actually started on that. If we get rid of the IRA and get rid of EV tax credits, what is the actual effect for the American consumer?
I don't know if it'll necessarily, well, yeah, it will. Dampening effect, in my opinion, on we'll say EV uptake. I don't think it's going to stop it, though. And I think it'll probably be detrimental to the domestic manufacturers in the long run. And I'm talking like a decade, 2 decades from now, because I think I think EVs will continue to increase in popularity. And then another manufacturer will step in to fill that demand. And I don't think the domestic manufacturers will have the technology to keep up with that.
I think if the demand for EVs goes down because they're more expensive, then they're, you know, $7,500 or whatever it might be, then that means that there's essentially less competition for ICE cars, you know, gas cars. And so if there's less competition, then what incentive does everybody else that isn't making EVs have to bring down prices either? So it seems to me that it would just make prices on automobiles in general go up more.
And the American consumer is definitely looking for lower priced,
yeah,
well, everything, but especially vehicles. I mean, the average cost of a brand new vehicle of any type, gas or electric, is up around $50,000.
Yeah.
That's a lot for a lot of people.
Yeah, no, it's
why there's like 7-8 whatever year long loans now, just to keep the monthly price down.
And people keeping their cars for longer times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So really what this boils down to essentially is supply and demand and how the market looks at options that are available. Do you think there would be any other like really significant impact if suddenly the entire tax credit just was not available at all?
I do. I couldn't tell you how though. I mean, it was certainly a motivating, a contributing factor for me getting mine at the time. I think it'll delay the accessibility of lower income earners to be able to get into that, you know, EV. But I think it'll certainly have impacts. I just couldn't really tell you where.
I think it's going to be a situation of, you know, butterfly effect, where it's just going to have ripple effects all over the place. And we're not going to really get an idea of what things are going to look like until after it happens.
I think it'll affect the impression that people have. I was at a local event today, and a lot of people were asking about the tax credit, because they've heard that it's there. Mm-hmm. So that alone helps push their interest and their curiosity, where I think once you're an EV owner, it's easy to look back and say, oh yeah, well, I love this, 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 and this about my car, and here's all the reasons why I bought it. But not necessarily for the next group of adopters. And this is something that I mentioned, actually, unfortunately, it had to be a two-part podcast because I got really ill recording. I had to stop, and I figured it was best just to get that part out there. But Andy, that's something that you had said you wanted to touch on. So I think it's probably good if we transition to maybe how this could influence the way we're talking about EVs in terms of marketing the concept of the technology to the next group of people that should be adopting it.
That's kind of some of the things that I've been trying this past month. We've just had a flurry of EV showcase events, and been going to it and trying to, you know, not alienate the person who's looking at the car. They truly are interested, but I also understand that I'm perceived as a salesman. You know, I basically have to crack the nut saying that I'm just here for an EV and I want to relay, you know, information to you. Kind of even like overcoming that initial hurdle is probably the hardest part. Once I do that, and I've come up with some techniques and ways, usually the conversation, you know, smooths out and they start relaxing. They, you know, questions come to mind and stuff like that. But I loved your two-part series just to kind of be able to address some of that. How do you get this next wave of people who are not the early adopters? They're more practical. They do want to do something right for the environment. They want to, but they also don't want to get steeped into the technical details. They just want to walk out there in their driveway and turn the car on and go and be able to know that they're going to arrive to their destination. So, trying to really just like discuss in general, opening it up for any like ideas of how to talk to those people and convey information and get them comfortable with the concept. So
you brought up a good point where step one is initiating the conversation, right? Like at a lot of these events, we either have a table or a booth or our cars, and the people that are going to approach us are curious. Mm-hmm. That curiosity is what is driving them to meet us where we are. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're always on board with the general idea of change.
Yeah.
I haven't checked YouTube, but I wonder if there are videos of just like how to drive an electric vehicle. And just and if there aren't, that'd be a good opportunity for EV Resource. Just like a, you know, 3-minute video of this is what it's like to get in, turn it on and go. And then people can see, oh, it's pretty much just like what I'm already doing. I don't really need to know anything special. It's just kind of normal.
Yeah, actually, like some of the usually the question comes around, okay, how much range? There's been a lot of talk about hybrid, and that's a new challenge to kind of hybrids are fine. I don't want to bash on them too much, but I really believe, you know, just in my experience, and this doesn't apply to everybody, but since having my car, I've just never really met a situation where I've been stranded or been afraid of being stranded. But that is the legitimate fear that people have. Like, are they going to go somewhere and essentially have the equivalent of ease of that, knowing that gas station is going to be there at that endpoint? You know, having essentially a charger in a similar situation, will the charger be at that endpoint that they're going to be and give them the comfort of mind to come back and return home without any issue, basically, and minimal thought behind it?
I've never been in a situation where I was going to get stranded. There's always been like, I know exactly where I'm going to charge and I know it's going to work. Unless I'm on a road trip in places where I haven't, you know, been around, but I have gotten to the point where because my particular car charges slow and range is a thing because it's less than 100 in almost every single case, miles. That I've had to increase the amount of time needed to charge, you know, out of my day. Like, it's like, well, that's an hour that I wasn't expecting to be sitting here before. But I think that's not exclusive to the Chevy Spark, but it's not a common experience in EV ownership in general at all.
John, you threw me off with the whole sitting there for an hour thing, because I know the Spark has a small battery. You can fill that at a fast charger in about 20 minutes. So you're just,
well, I don't have fast chargers. It's level two. I can get about 16 miles of charge per hour or thereabouts.
Yeah.
With level one, it's about 5.25 miles every hour. And with a fast charger, it's about 55 miles.
If you're lucky.
On a good fast charger.
Yeah. I know it was rated at 50. But we don't need to get into technical specifications of the Spark EV. There are two videos that I saw that how to drive an electric car. Obviously, I haven't watched them in the couple minutes here, but I don't even know that we need that. And the reason I think that is because, to your point, in some ways, it's just like driving a normal car. The way to spread that message is through events, experience events.
Yeah.
Nothing against events where you have EV owners that are standing there with their cars to talk about them. Mm-hmm. But we need more events where people can get their butts behind the wheel and butts in seats and drive the car and go, oh, this is okay.
I agree that would be the best, but I think in general, if the problem here is fear of the unknown and people aren't able to get to events for whatever reason, and or they're, I mean, obviously, like, to your point, there aren't enough. I would still say the second best would be to have a video that says, here you go. Here's the information so that you don't have to be afraid of it. But I agree that the experience would be much better.
Why not both?
Well, yeah.
Sure. One of the things that I've found is a significant hurdle, especially for people that aren't necessarily willing to be the early adopters of any technology, is the price point. Mm-hmm. So getting the price point as low as possible is of paramount importance for rolling out greater adoption numbers. That seems to be contrary to what the manufacturers are trying to do. They don't necessarily want to sell cheap EVs. They want to sell cars that have a high profit margin. What do you think about that?
I agree. I was talking about that with someone today. And I think you pointed this out, Zach, is like there's still like, say, a learning curve to selling EVs versus the ICE component. And I think when it comes to the dealerships, like, it's just easier for them to sell the ICE component because they don't have to worry about spending any time educating. So they can just sell their ICE, next person, sell ICE, mm-hmm. you know, where EVs, like, you got to convince the person and then you got to educate them. And that's a legitimate amount of time that I don't think the salesman has any interest in doing, but not without incentives, I'll say that.
Sure.
But, it's, not sure where I think I might have lost the point on that, but that's definitely an observation. I think that is also an impedance to, you know, getting EVs into more common people's hands.
Yet we have so many manufacturers of EVs that do not have dealerships.
True.
Right? Where Tesla doesn't have a dealership. They have a service center or an experience center like Lucid, Rivian, many of these companies, they have places where people can go to get educated about the vehicle, but not necessarily have salespeople. Like, Tesla's salespeople do not make commissions. They're there primarily and solely really to educate and walk people through what that process would be like, but they aren't incentivized to sell anything other than what is in front of them, which mm-hmm. in that case would be a Tesla vehicle. Is there a way that that could be adopted to the traditional part of the industry where you might have a car dealership that sells Jeep, Dodge, Chrysler, Ram, maybe throw Mazda into the mix or Ford? Like, not every dealership only has one brand that they sell.
I pray for that every day. And that's actually something that's kind of maybe like a implied point here. Like, that's a unique experience to EVs because it's new companies that are behind EVs that basically allow you to just pull it up on the app and buy it. I mean, that's unheard of for any kind of ICE vehicles.
It took me less than 10 minutes to buy our Tesla. I was on my couch.
I didn't even realize that these companies didn't have dealerships. I was just thinking that, well, I live in the middle of nowhere, you know, in a rural area. And of course, there's no dealers for Lucid or Rivian or even Tesla around here. And so it didn't. My next question is, well, how do you buy these vehicles? And I guess that anybody who's going to buy one of these vehicles is going to have to really purposefully go out of their way to do so. Whereas, I don't know, I don't feel like an electric car is really an impulse buy. Like, ICE vehicles, it's very easy that I could see that you end up like going into a dealership like, well, I don't really have any intention to buy a car today. And then somebody talks to you and says, hey, here's what the monthly payment's going to be. And here's what we can give you for your existing car, trade it in, let's go. And then you're like, an hour later, walking out of there with a car going, I don't know what just happened. So it's like, how do we get to that point with electric cars? Because in terms of EV adoption, I feel like that would be a good thing.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Hyundai is trying a model through Amazon. I don't think it's in effect yet, but where essentially you can actually go on Amazon and make a purchase of a car. And now the dealership does still get involved because essentially you go and pick it up at a dealership. But
yeah, so I do have Hyundai, Kia. I don't know if they do Genesis. I would assume so, but at least Hyundai and Kia dealerships around here.
Yeah. Yeah. So
they were surprised that I thought that an Ioniq 6 looked like a Saab on the rear. I was like, I'm standing by my opinion here.
Hey, I can see that. I was thinking like Porsche, but yeah, there's some Saab to that as well.
Okay. They look genuinely insulted. I'm like, I kind of feel bad for saying that now.
No, I'm trying to think like which model of Saab?
The 900.
Oh, okay. I see it. Yeah. I didn't think about that one.
Like from the 90s?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm with you. Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Okay. So I was trying to lead the conversation, failed miserably.
What was the question again?
Well, EVs, Americans want lower priced EVs. So where I was planning to head is the next story, the news story that I wanted to touch on with much more affordable EVs entering the US market from China. Because they can make really good EVs for less money than what we'll see typically from many auto manufacturers stateside. And I don't think it's because manufacturers here are incapable. I think it's going to take time. The economies of scale haven't been built out. I mean, Ford recently, and it's not a story that I plan to get into, but they reported that they have lost a lot of money per EV. Well, that's because of the research and development and infrastructure, battery, manufacturing, vehicle manufacturing that had to be built to support that over time and at greater scale. Clearly, that fixed cost gets spread out into more units. Well, mm-hmm. a lot of the Chinese manufacturers, BYD, XPeng, NIO, they already have a massive scale because of the Chinese market is way ahead of everyone else in the world. In fact, BYD sells more plug-in vehicles than any other manufacturer in the world. Not more pure battery electric vehicles, that's Tesla, but plug-in hybrids included, they're number one. So they've got that economy of scale, so they can provide exactly what the US consumer wants. But it's not what American manufacturers want. So I don't think it's happened yet. No
business is going to want increased competition necessarily.
Sure. And I'm not necessarily saying that I want China as a country or political entity to have an open door to the US market. So I find personally, I'm conflicted on this. Biden is planning to, I don't think it's happened quite yet, increase tariffs on Chinese electric vehicle that might be entering. And I believe I've seen some of the numbers that it's like quadrupling the tariff.
Yeah.
Basically to try to lock them out of bringing affordable options over here, because like we saw in the 70s and 80s with Honda and Toyota, I really think if we didn't have this walled tariff protection, we would see BYD and XPeng and NIO absolutely dominate the North American market.
Yeah, I agree. Sorry, John, go ahead.
I was going to say, what you're saying is that we should find a way to bring them to Canada and then import them from Canada.
Well, that's what China's trying to do with Mexico.
Hey, so BYD, I know they've gone back and forth with the official statement, but there's been a lot of chatter about BYD building a manufacturing plant in Mexico or taking over an existing manufacturing plant in Mexico. If they were to do that, especially if they created a North American-based subsidiary, well, now they're not a Chinese company. I don't know if a tariff would apply. And if we were doing anything on Mexican goods coming into the country, that would have some major implications. And I don't even know if that's something that we would be willing to go that far. So if a company can just build manufacturing wherever, and the origin of the parts and the origin of the manufacturing and assembly is in North America, and we'll, let's just say the United States. So we're providing tax revenue, we're providing jobs, and we're supporting the infrastructure and ecosystem here. Does it matter what company that is?
It might to some people if the Chinese government is getting involved.
Yes, I do think that there is a privacy aspect to that, John. Like, I think you're right in that regard. But to your point, Zach, I think it would be a credit to the IRA that it would force, you know, the manufacturing to essentially employ North Americans rather than having China leverage its full force of its manufacturing ability mm-hmm. against us. So there is a positive aspect to that. But
would that affect the price of the cars then?
That was my next thought too, is, okay, would they still be able to offer vehicles for, I mean, honestly, even if it was $5,000 less than your average run-of-the-mill EV, I think probably. I go back and forth because I certainly want to see U.S. manufacturers be successful, and threatening their viability is definitely a concern. But then also, if the American consumer wants lower priced vehicles, and I truly believe that competition driving prices down is good for the consumer, then shouldn't, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm stuck in the middle because I'm going, well, wait, it's a good thing, but then also maybe not.
Yeah. Well, here's one observation back to the very beginning of this conversation, is I think that America has kind of left manufacturers on their own, and the exact opposite of that has happened in China. And that is why they are so far ahead in terms of they've been doing it for longer, and they've had the support of not only the government, but probably its citizens to move in that direction. And they've just gone gung-ho with it. And that's one of the reasons they're so far ahead. And they also had the foresight to say, like, if we're going to do this, we need good batteries. And that's probably why they also captured that battery market. Here in contrast to America, we haven't given that kind of support to our manufacturing. The most we've done is, you know, those credits, the $7,500 credit, and that's about it. The rest has been, you're on your own. You got to figure it out. So it's been up to Ford to rely on their ICE sales to finance essentially their EV research. And so they've had to home grow all this stuff. And it's just like, there's such a contrast in the support between how the country is trying to support the EV industry. And so that's one of the reasons mainly why China can, I think, be so cheap right now. And they have powerful manufacturing. They manufacture for the world. So they just have that ability to bring to the, you know, they can leverage against us or anybody, not just Americans. I mean, it's happening in Europe as well. And it's kind of freaking them out.
And I think part of the thing with the privacy, it's like, how many things do you have in your house that came from China, especially electronics, and you're not worried about any of that? So yeah. How is this any different?
My choppy camera is one of those things right now.
iPhones count, right?
Manufacturer.
I think they're manufactured in China.
Does Foxconn have facilities in China?
Yeah, I thought they were
listening to the podcast. Zach is pointing to things around the room that he's currently in, trying to
see everything. I mean,
yeah, everything. Like, my monitor, I'm watching you guys on the keyboard. I have the speakerphone. Everything.
I got two monitors here. One's an LG, so we got Korea there, but the other one is Hanspree. And I'd make a guess that's China, maybe Taiwan.
I guess mine's Asus, LG, so that's Korean. Asus, I think, is Taiwanese, right? So
I don't know off the top of my head. Anyway.
Technically China.
So, I mean, throughout the modern industrial era, like, let's go 150 years plus, like, there's always been competition between countries. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it's just that I'm becoming more aware, or if things are just the information is more accessible because of the internet and the way news works these days. But is this more of a problem or concern or challenge now than it has been previously? Like, what is China a big concern because we should be concerned, or does the prospect of really affordable EVs coming from a different country, like, is that just something that's kind of getting overblown?
I wasn't really paying attention so well at the time in the 80s when this similar situation was, you know, with Japanese manufacturing. And that kind of settled on its own. I do see this as like one battle in the major consolidation, a major final consolidation, of global consolidation, because China is kind of the last frontier when it comes to just your citizenship, the amount of citizens that you have, and the labor that they can just bring to bear. I do think that there's going to be some major fallout at the end of this. I'm not answering your question very well, but at the end of this EV battle, I think there's going to be a major fallout in that there will be major manufacturers that will go out of business and not survive this. But that's the best I could tell you right now.
Some minor ones already.
Well, yeah. I mean, there actually Arcimoto. I am not getting any response from people that I know, like nothing, like not even a non-response as a response. But their webpage has been down for a month. The latest news reports I can find say that basically, like, there's lawsuits against them for non-payment to their suppliers, that the electricity was turned off for the manufacturing facility. I don't know. I would love to know more about what's going on, just to personally just put my mind at ease, because I really want an Arcimoto, and I would buy one even if the company went out of business, because I would learn how to fix it myself. But that's just one example of many that what I think is going to shake things up is when we have an existing manufacturer. And I'm not saying this will happen, but let's just put Toyota out there, because typically people point to them as going, oh, they're not going to survive because they're not moving fast enough with EVs. But when either, let's say, Subaru, Mazda, Toyota, even Honda, or some of the European brands, or gosh, I mean, even if Chevy ended or GM ended Buick, or, you know, that is when I think it's going to really shake things up. Do you think that's inevitable?
I definitely think some brands will consolidate, like we saw with Stellantis. That will continue to happen. And crazy thought, but maybe instead of, you know, Stellantis or Ford or GM or Volkswagen being a household name, a new household name will be Geely. Yeah. They're just a monster.
How many brands does Geely have under their umbrella at this point?
Man, I don't know. I know Polestar, Volvo, they got the Zeekr brand. but that's about the extent of my knowledge. But I know that you always hear them basically whenever a manufacturer becomes a good deal, you usually see their name pop up in the purchase.
I think it's going to take a long time for Geely to be a household name, just because I guarantee you, if I pulled 10 people off the street, zero out of 10 would have ever heard of Stellantis.
True. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Like nobody knows
Chrysler or something like that.
Oh yeah. You say Chrysler, you say Dodge, Jeep, whatever. They'll be like, oh yeah, sure. Stellantis. Wait, what's that?
Yeah.
Nobody will know.
Okay. But
I think regardless of EV adoption, or what happens with the technology, there's going to be consolidation and startups and massive changes happening with the automotive industry. Regardless, people have been saying that for a little while. I think 20 years from now, the landscape's going to be entirely different in terms of manufacturers and whatnot, regardless of what happens with technology.
All right, Andy, I just pulled up Geely.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And I'm going to read it off because there's no way I'm going to have this memorized. So there's Geely Holding Group that is like parent company. And then you have Geely Auto Group, which is made up of Geely Auto, Link and Company, Livian or Livan, Proton, one that's in Chinese that I can't read. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then you've got Volvo and Polestar, Zeekr, Lotus, Smart.
That's right.
LEVC, which is the London Electric Vehicle Company. So that's all the black cabs in London.
Uh-huh.
And then Radar Auto. So that's what, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And yeah, that's just for passenger cars. That doesn't even get into commercial vehicles or motorcycles or anything else. I mean, I didn't.
Yeah, BYD, they're just going to become.
I didn't realize Lotus was a part of Geely.
I didn't. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Or if I did know, I completely forgot about it too. Like, that is interesting.
What I want to know is when there's going to be an electric TVR.
All right, fine. I can look that up.
That's not
it. Took me a second to pull that up out of the archives. I only know it because I watched a Top Gear episode on it or something like that.
All right. So if you go to TVR's webpage, there is the Griffith EV.
No kidding.
And it just says, want further details, register your interest, but nothing else. Like, there's no specs, there's no timeline, there's a photo, a rendering. But they have it on their webpage. So,
all right.
Let's give them that.
Another one, MG, right? Does Geely own MG? I guess you didn't list it off there, so I'm not sure who does.
Yeah, so this is the funny thing, right? The entire automobile industry has always had companies with either an entire ownership or majority stakes in other companies. Like Ford, I think, owned Mazda during the 90s and like early 2000s.
Yeah.
And then sold that part. We talked about Saab. Well, Saab was its own thing. And then GM was involved. And basically that spelled the demise of Saab. Does that really matter? Like, does the brand name that's on the car actually really matter anymore? I mean,
are you asking me if I care that Saturn is no longer a thing?
Sure, John. How sad are you?
I am not sad.
I mean, we have cars now, EVs now, the Jaguar I-Pace. Great example. Jaguar does not build that car. It's manufactured by Magna in Austria. You have the Fisker Ocean, also manufactured by Magna. I don't know where we're going with this, but like, how much does that brand name actually really matter anymore?
Hmm. Good question. It might not so much.
I don't think it does.
On. Yeah. I think it'll be a value proposition in the long run that would compel people to buy whatever brand.
So that just takes us back to if it's quality,
mm-hmm.
and people still look at China as being cheap Chinese junk that's low quality, and that's how the price is achieved. Well, while I've not seen or experienced Chinese EVs myself, I know people who have and have spoken very highly of the quality, that mm-hmm. they're very well built. So if we're getting a very well built, high value product for a lower price, is the only reason to increase tariffs to protect GM, Ford, Stellantis to a point? Like,
I think there's two reasons for the tariffs. One, yeah, to protect existing car makers that are selling cars in North America. And two, because people are genuinely concerned about the Chinese government spying on American citizens, which may or may not be founded, but people are concerned about it. But I think people buy a story. It's not just the value proposition. If there's a story around something like Ferrari, nobody buys a Ferrari because they're a value proposition. I don't know, depending on how you're defining value there, maybe they do because the story is part of the value then. All sales are emotional, you know, and it could be emotion behind taking care of your family. And because of that, my budget is a problem and, you know, budget is a concern, and there we go. But somebody who might have a little bit more disposable income, are they going to buy a BYD? You're going to need a story.
I think BYD, from a brand standpoint, absolutely has a good story. Their name stands for Build Your Dreams. It's interesting you brought up Ferrari. I was on Facebook and I saw a story that compared the Ferrari F40 and the Porsche 959. Both very, very awesome supercars in their time, and they were competitors.
Mm-hmm.
The Ferrari was basically a carbon composite body, extremely lightweight, no driver assistance. The technology, like, it was not there. It was basically the closest you could get to a race car that was barely road legal. In contrast, the Porsche 959 was extremely advanced technology, all-wheel drive system. They had 8 dampers for the suspension. Wow. Like, this was something that Porsche poured their engineering prowess into.
Yeah.
It was a test bed in a lot of ways.
It was.
Yeah. Fast forward 40 years now, and nobody really talks about the Porsche 959. In fact, it doesn't, like, you can get one for half the cost of what you could get a Ferrari F40. The better car that was packed full of technology is not worth as much. So it goes to something, John, I think you were nodding to, where it has to do with the feeling that we get when driving. This post, while it didn't specifically say anything about EVs, it did say that the lesson to be learned was technology will always evolve and will always improve. And if you base your product offering off of technology, then as time passes, it's not going to be something that's remembered and valued the way something else, in this case, the Ferrari F40, because of that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So my first thought is, that's EVs. EVs are putting the technology out there. So if it's not continually improving, like, what EVs 40 years from now are going to be really worth a whole lot, kind of in the same comparison?
There's not that super yet. Yeah.
And maybe it'll be based on whatever technology evolves to over the next 40 years. And I don't even know if we're going to have cars at that point.
I think you're probably talking about Model S Plaid and Taycan and Lucid, maybe like a Sapphire or something.
Maybe
those hypercars. Yeah, maybe
because of the way they make you feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Haven't driven the Lucid Sapphire. I did drive the, I guess it was the equivalent of the long range Lucid, the Air Dream Edition, I think it was. Driven the Model S Plaid, not nearly as much as I would have liked to. By the way, if anybody that listens to this is in Virginia or Maryland and wants to meet up at the track with their Plaid, let me know. I'm not desperate, but I really want to. And then John and I both got the opportunity to drive the Porsche Taycan over at New Jersey Motorsports Park at autocross course.
It was an autocross course with cones in a parking lot that could not stretch its legs. It needed a bigger track.
We'll get there. They are pretty spectacular cars, but while, take the Plaid for example, the acceleration, it's bonkers. I mean, it's violent.
Yeah.
Like John, I think you lost a pair of sunglasses that was sitting on top of your head like this.
They weren't even that far up. They were just like basically on the front of my head, like on my hat, like resting on the bill of my hat, and they still flew off.
Wow. Yeah, but I get disoriented in my car. I did, and then also I at the Virginia Auto Show, I rode in that GT. It was last year, the Mustang GT, and that mm-hmm. was scarier. And it just, it's disorienting to me. I actually feel my brain like
yeah.
falling back in my head a little bit when that much power is applied. So I cannot even imagine a Plaid.
My insides are not supposed to feel like that, but I'll take it.
I think there's so much that we could talk about related to EV performance. Uh-huh. I actually want to kind of tie up and put a nice bow on this episode. Because I think we're over an hour at this point. I don't know what it'll be total, but I don't think there's going to be much editing that I do outside of taking away some of the shorter, like the gaps between talking. So definitely want to tie it together. What would your big takeaway from a lot of the news that we've been hearing? What would be the big thing that you think is kind of the most important aspect of what we've talked about? What would that be?
Elon's crazy and we're just going to have to wait and see on a lot of things related to the EV industry.
Hey. And that's the first thing that popped in my mind. Not so blunt, but I was just kind of a wait and see. I think we can't really rely on Tesla anymore to move us forward in the EV space. I think it is going to be an industry-wide effort to move us forward.
I love that, Andy.
Yeah.
That's the right way for an industry to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it would be really great, actually, if it all comes together.
All right. Any last words?
Well, Zach, what do you drive and what drives you?
Well, I think I've mentioned it, but since selling you the Spark and I was overly optimistic when I ordered the Aptera thinking that the original timeline was going to be held. So while I waited, I bought a 2005 Scion XB with 200 at that point, 280 something thousand miles on it. Now I'm
Andy,
just shy.
You're making me sorry I asked.
No, look, it's a great car. I'm almost 295,000 miles on it. And being a former Toyota tech, I don't care what goes wrong with it because it's a gas powered car. Things go wrong. Like I got to replace the brakes tomorrow. Like I can fix it. So it's fine. It's perfect for what I needed in the moment while I'm waiting on something else. I think, God, this is interesting being asked my own questions that I ask people. What drives me ultimately at the end of the day? I feel good about contributing to the world as a whole, but helping move the EV transition forward. And even if that's influencing somebody to buy an electric car, like at one point, the first person that ever told me they bought an electric car because of what they learned from me, like that still, that feeling still sticks with me. But I've always asked, like, well, why is that important? Like, why is everybody driving electric vehicles or clean vehicles that don't emit exhaust? Why is that important? And environmental reasons have never been my big thing. But the more I've learned about it, the more I realized that public health and clean air, that's my big push, the big reason why I'm focused on alternative fuels across the board. And it's not just EVs. You know, if we can get renewable propane out there, renewably sourced hydrogen, there's places for that. Mm-hmm. So if we can get public health improved, that saves a ton of money. It has a ripple effect throughout most, if not all, of society. So I guess that's what drives me. On the larger scale, on a smaller scale, like, I just want to make a difference and I want to make the world a better place. So there you go.
I'll add to that, Zach. I love your podcast, and I think it's one of the more unique ones out there. And you're definitely like pioneering in some of the podcasts that you've put out and exposure that you've given to some of the, I guess, lesser known things about the aspects of EV out there. So I want to say, just give you credit that you're doing a great job at it. So
it's nice to hear these interviews with people in the industry that you didn't even know existed or that their position even existed.
Yeah.
Sure. And that actually is one of the things that when I made the shift to focus more on interviews versus the latest news, that actually was the feedback that I was getting was, everybody can kind of do the news. The reason that people liked me doing the news was that a lot of the times I'd have a different perspective or just slightly some commentary that was not what you'd hear everywhere else. But then also that interviews give a little bit different perspective. And a lot of the time people will not share the same things, even if they've been on multiple podcasts or multiple news platforms. You might be able to pull something different out of that conversation. But then also, I love just having conversations versus it being one way. So that's one of the reasons why I want to thank both of you for joining me to talk about the news. Plus, I really think it's not just straight news anymore, right? But being able to engage in conversation about what's going on versus something that's cold or sterile. So as much as I want all of my audience to appreciate that, I very much appreciate when I have the opportunity to speak like we have today. So I want to thank both of you for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I can't wait for us to do it again.
Okay. Yeah, wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks.
If you've enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more, please subscribe to wherever you like to watch or listen to your favorite podcasts. And if you're looking to stay plugged into the EV community, head over to ev-resource.com for the very best educational resources, community connections, EV reviews, and a whole lot more. The EV Resource Podcast is a production of EV Resource and is supported by viewers and listeners just like you. Members of the EV Resource Patreon family are, at the director tier, Rajiv Narayan and Andy Cooper, at the executive producer tier, Christopher Lawrence, and at the producer tier, Eric Weber and Tony Stuntz. If you're interested in ad-free episodes of the podcast, EV Resource merchandise, support recognition, and more, head over to patreon.com/EV Resource. If you have any feedback, please email hello@ev-resource.com and put podcast feedback in the subject line. I've been your host, Zach Hurst. Thank you so much for watching and listening, and we'll catch you next time.